Pete. How you doing, my friend?
Good. How are you, Todd?
Busy on the road a good bit. Everything is Ukraine is still going. People are still dying. We're about to have another war in Iran. Before we get started, what's your sense of what's happening geopolitically here? I feel like there's huge information wars happening, and we're like watching them real time, right? It's almost like Gangs of New York, where you have different factions trying to control, I think, resources, routes. What say you? Any insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, and I think what you're referring to is just the varied narratives that we're hearing.
Yes.
We very clearly have a mainstream media that still is conjoined by one goal, and that's, you know, anything that can cast shade on Donald Trump and his administration is good, and anything that shines a positive light on the administration is bad.
Yeah.
And so with both Iran and Ukraine, you've got this, what, you know, I consider myself a historian.
Yeah.
For the first time in history, you know, you've got this internal element in the United States and in Western Europe working against what is ultimately the best interests of their own people and the people of these countries, which is peace and stopping the killing. And so, you know, the biggest downfall to me about Iran is that it has taken attention away from Ukraine.
Yes.
And all the progress it looked like we were making toward a peace agreement was just put into limbo until the Iran situation is cleared up. And, you know, the sense of urgency has not diminished. It's increased. Men are still dying at, you know, jaw-dropping rates, and they're still dying for no reason. And then, you know, we've got this stalemate in Iran. So, you know, that's where I wanted to start today, because it kind of leads into the Ukraine update.
You know, we've got everything ready. Do you want me to run that short video?
Yeah, well, let me just intro it. Sure. You know, we want to update on Iran real quick. Negotiations are still ongoing between Iran and the U.S., as well as the major Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, to name the three most powerful. And those negotiations and the ceasefire are in their fifth week. So, you know, we've been 5 weeks of negotiation and ceasefire. And the reason we don't have a lot of information on who specifically the U.S. is talking to is because the exact status in the negotiations has to be kept secret. Again, due to what we just talked about, the global MSN's ongoing attempts to sabotage anything that comes out. That report we talked about last week, which said Iran retained 75% of its missiles and air defense, has already been debunked, proven to be completely false. But that's part of the sabotage. That's part of this crazy dynamic we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, not just sabotage, is not reporting on what's happening inside Iran. And to me, that's the story to focus on continuously. And
yes,
that's where we have our first video. It comes from Iran International. I recommend that site to all of our viewers. It's got good content. That's where we got the raw cell phone footage of the protests in January. And some of the protests that have gone on since. So let's go ahead and roll that real quick, Todd.
They sure claim that this is like there's a fear of cyber attacks. But when you look at the big picture, it's really about controlling the narrative, the controlling the information space and how Iranians inside the country feel in this moment. And it's clear when they're offering white sims to pro-regime journalists, analysts, and even Western social media influencers that are visiting the country to whitewash the events of January, for instance, which were the anti-regime uprising that resulted in the unprecedented massacre of tens of thousands of Iranians. And so when you look at that, you say, well, I guess it's really not about national security. It's about who you decide gets control of the internet. And so we're seeing this digital inequality play out right now in this information space. And really what it comes down to is a fear of its people speaking out. We've seen this for years now. It started with the 2009 post-election protests known as the Green Movement. And it was really then that the Islamic Republic started viewing the internet and social media as a national security threat. And so over the years, they've been implementing blocking of websites. 35% of the most visited websites globally, including all social media platforms, are blocked. And so Iranians have been using circumvention tools to get online. So this isn't really new, but this is taking it to a new extreme or a new normal.
It's just talking about the Iran 70-day internet, 75, I believe it is, day internet blackout. And why is this important? Because at first glance, you might think it's what governments do to shut down, make temporary security measures during wartime by containing, you know, or restricting images of repression from reaching the outside world. But the continuation of these connectivity restrictions for more than 70 days points to something far more sinister, which is crowd control and censorship. And what the Iranian authorities appear to fear is not merely the circulation of information, but the social and political connectivity that allows dissent to transform into collective action. And the internet, that's the real power, the people power of the internet. The internet allows a protest in one city to rapidly become a national experience, and it allows citizens to realize. Todd, it's pretty, if you can mute your mic, it's pretty loud on your side. But the social and political connectivity allows dissent to transform into collective action. And the internet allows that to happen. And, you know, the most important part about it is what I said, you know, you can take events in one city and make them a national experience, and it allows citizens to become consciously aware that dissent, their own dissent, their own frustration is not isolated, and that they're not alone. There are others that continue to resist. And when we see it in this light, the internet shutdown is not simply about blocking news, it's about disrupting the connective tissue of resistance. And another reason this is important for us in the United States is because we, the people of the United States, can relate to this, because we were victims of the same tactics under the Biden administration, as Biden's FBI San Francisco office served as the gatekeeper of what dialogue was permissible and what dialogue was impermissible communication content for Twitter, Facebook, and other social media channels. And is, you know, as an example, I live in California, but the county I live in is full of freedom-loving people who, like me, love California and despise the senseless political extremism that has been governing it for quite some time.
And at some point, I want to do a show on you with you on that, because it's really a big issue.
Yeah, I'd love to do that too. Many times during the pandemic, you know, I would run into friends or business colleagues who live in different areas of California, and I'd listen to them, and you quickly realize that they're an island of sanity in a sea of senselessness. And these people would be ecstatic once you started talking and tell them, no, that's not what's happening. I totally agree with you, because they find out they're not alone and that there's others who are skeptical, in this case, of the supposed pandemic, the severity of it, as well as the shot they were telling everyone to take to stop it. And, you know, I also bring that up because on a lesson learned note, this is why it makes sense to always have backup communication in the event of specifically a natural disaster, like out here for us, a massive earthquake, or if you're in the East Coast, a massive hurricane and earthquake. Or another man-made disaster by political extremists. So back to the Iranian regime, you know, one of the most important functions of digital connectivity in a protest movement is it is just that it breaks political isolation. And propaganda purveyors and psychological manipulation depends heavily, and we've talked about this before, on convincing citizens that they're alone and they're powerless and they're unsupported and their view is a one-off crazy view, so don't talk about it. And that's the power of the internet network. Networks undermine isolation. And when individuals realize that others continue to resist, private fear can gradually evolve into collective confidence. And so in conclusion, you know, on Iran specifically, a government that fears connectivity at this level ultimately is afraid of something far deeper. It's fears of society, of the people themselves. And in any state forced to isolate an entire country in order to preserve political control reveals not confidence in its stability, but profound anxiety over its fragility. And that's what's happening in Iran right now, as well as all around the world. So we said it last week, we'll say it again, it's the new theme of Iran. Whenever you hear someone talk about Iran or what's going to happen, remember the Iranian people, think about the Iranian people. That's what this is about and what it needs to stay about in the future.
So let me just jump in there, but for our people listening, we're hiring and redoing this entire production facility, as well as hiring producers and other stuff. So hopefully this stuff that's been happening won't happen in the future. But anyway, stay with us. You want to move on to antivirus now?
Yeah. And I wouldn't worry about it, Todd. It's good. It's the raw, you know, ground up.
It is raw. Gorilla, and by the way, I know
gorilla
you like to
reporting.
Post. Yeah, totally, man. Totally. I'm here among all the gorillas.
Yeah, you
for
are.
Sure. So yeah. I was going to say, I'm going to cut this for you and send you the with all the stuff perfected before you post it. So I'll get that to you within the hour. But go
yeah.
ahead.
Let's do the hantavirus update. I put that in because we talked about it last week, mm-hmm. But it folds in, this story folds in to what we're exactly talking about. You know, we everyone should know that the hantavirus is not a threat. As we talked about last week, its human-to-human contagion aspects are so minuscule that, you know, you have to understand what they are, which is, there's only one strain of hantavirus. It's not in the U.S. It's in the Andes. It's still extremely rare for human-to-human contagion. And we now know that it can only happen when two humans exchange bodily fluids. And even then, it's not a sure thing. But that doesn't dissuade CNN from trying to take advantage of this and once again using fear to manipulate people, and in hopes of maybe rolling it into something for the midterm elections.
They're definitely working it hard.
Yeah. So let's transition to Ukraine and Europe. And I think you have a video of a Lithuanian foreign ministry comment. Under the heading of "The Insanity Continues," the Lithuanian...
Is this the one with Zelensky, or which one is that?
No, that's next.
Okay. I have the slide. Hold on. There you go.
Yeah. And so just to sum this up, the Lithuanian foreign ministry, yes, Lithuanian foreign ministry, called on NATO to attack Kaliningrad, you know, which is a massively strategically important city to Russia. It's their access to the Baltic Sea. And it's almost as if this is the onset of a new tactic by the EU, like they've now given up trying to convince the people of Europe that Russia will lose. So they've switched to their second, you know, false threat, which is that Russia will attack the rest of Europe and that they're an existential threat to Europe. Which they've not, we've said this many times, they've never made a statement nor taken any action to show they're trying to take over the rest of Europe. And for anyone who's objective, you would realize, why would Russia want the rest of Europe? Why would they want these countries that have rendered themselves almost ungovernable? They all have to correct what's happened. And those are the big ones, Britain, Germany, France, especially. But, you know, in order to do that, it looks like they're now trying to stoke Russia into something outside of Ukraine, perhaps a false flag operation. We're seeing all these UAVs, these drones cutting through these EU Baltic states now. You know, it's something that bears watching, and it, the most important aspect of it is they're not giving up. The EU is just continuing to double down on this whole charade. And that's why I said in the beginning, the biggest downside to me of the Iran situation is that it's taken the attention off of this insanity in Ukraine and the rest of Europe.
Let me jump in there. Kaliningrad is, you can see in this picture there, is an exclave of Russia in the Baltics to the west of the Baltic countries. And it was funny because when the Ukraine war started, some idiot in the EU, you know, administration put up a big map, and it had a one side white, one side red, and it said, this is Russia and this is not, you know, mocking the Kremlin. And they forgot about Kaliningrad, which was Russia inside Western Europe. So
yeah,
it is a big deal. It's the old Prussian, you know, state area that Russia basically has had since World War II. So it's fascinating that Europe is now focusing on, you know, starting a war there, essentially. And that's been the fear, the gap coming from Russia. What's it called? I forget the name of the gap that was the big Cold War.
The Fulda Gap.
Yeah, right there through the Baltics and Belarus, which is white Russia, into that area is what all of NATO's war plans were focused on during the Cold War. So anyway, back to you.
Yeah, and Russia wasn't just given Kaliningrad. They lost hundreds of thousands of soldiers during the war during World War II, defending it. And so it's not something to be, you know, it's not a triviality. A lot of people don't even know it exists or the geography of it. And Todd, if you remember, probably 6 months ago on this show, we talked about a couple of our favorite generals, American generals from the EU, actually mentioned Kaliningrad as we need to look at potential to take back Kaliningrad. They made that statement. So, you know, for Russia, it's not something to just dismiss as another empty threat from the EU. This is what, you know, what we're talking about. They're stoking the flames. It looks like they're prepping another course of action to provoke Russia into doing something. But the insanity of it, just like the insanity of what they did in Ukraine, doesn't make any sense. And hopefully we can put a stop to it with peace talks.
Yeah, we just need to keep highlighting it, keep talking about this.
Yep.
Go ahead.
So let's go to that Zelensky, retro about his taking power. So 7 years ago, on May 20th, 2019, Zelensky's inauguration took place. He officially assumed the president of Ukraine. So 7 years now. And in the video, you'll see the Rada. And it's an interesting sight because the report on it went through the, you know, looked at who was in the Rada at the time and who's gone. And more than half of those who were in the crowd cheering him on are no longer alive or have fled abroad. And as you know, as someone who's been there multiple times, one of the biggest losses to Ukraine is that their intelligentsia, beat feet long time ago. they are not in Ukraine anymore, and they took all their families with them. And of course, you know, moves like that are contagious. They stoke the fears of the people. If they're leaving, it must be really bad. And it explains why so many others have fled. And we've got another story about young men in a minute. But, you know, it's what I want to do right now is just take a look at the result of this, of Zelensky being put in power by the EU and
the
US.
Every day, your data is being tracked, collected, and sold, often without you even realizing it. Big tech companies control your devices, your apps, and the information you share. From your messages to your browsing habits, everything is being monitored and stored. Over time, we've traded privacy for convenience, and most people don't even question it. But what if you could take that control back? That's where Mark 37 comes in. Mark 37 provides privacy-focused phones, laptops, and tablets designed to give you full control over your digital life. With secure systems, expert support, and simple tools, they make it easier to step away from constant tracking and data collection. Because privacy isn't just a feature, it's a fundamental choice. It's about protecting your data, your freedom, and your future. Take back control of your digital life with Mark 37.
Divorce is tough, but your finances don't have to be. I'm David Cross, and I'm a certified divorce financial analyst practitioner. My job is to help you get a fair financial settlement in your divorce and to guide you to smarter money decisions. Find out how we can help you. U.S. Asset Management, it's your money and your future.
And what's happened to the country, which is basically it's turned into a fake country, which is has no economy. Its economy is the war. The article, I think, calls him Ukraine a bankrupt beggar, which it is. They can't exist without handouts. And they're dependent now on these Western partners, the EU partners, for support. And, you know, if you're dependent on MERS, Macron, and Starmer for your existence, you're standing on thin ice. And again, you know, Ukraine's economy is the war. They Zelensky's done nothing to build, you know, a parallel Western free market economy, which Ukraine has huge potential to do. But again, that starts with getting the intelligentsia back, getting people to believe in what's happening, and none of that's happening. So, you know, we talked about in retrospect, you know, how's this former actor, comedian, who never wrote or commented so much as a tweet or anything on social media, any paper, about foreign affairs or domestic Ukraine politics. He was a TV star. He didn't campaign to be president. He was inserted by his billionaire backer, Timur Mindich, who has since fled the country and taken refuge in Israel, of all places. So Zelensky didn't campaign.
He can play the piano with his penis. So he does have that talent. Don't forget that.
We had a report on that too. It's mind-boggling. So Zelensky didn't campaign. He refused to debate. We talked about Mindich, his other backer, Andrei Yermak, just was released from prison. He's been indicted and arrested for corruption, specifically $100 million corruption in the energy sector. So that's what he's done. Let's also look at what he did last week. We talked about this already, but it's important. Last week, Zelensky extended his decree on martial law, which is a part of a suite of wartime powers that suspends elections, bans opposition parties, and shuts down all media organizations except those run by state, which, to all of our listeners, this is the very definition of totalitarianism and a totalitarian state. So
this is also, Pete, very similar to what happened to Russia, because They sent a Bolshevik, i.e. Lenin, put him on a train with, you know, the doors were welded shut, sent him into Moscow to foment this revolution and destroy the country. And Russia didn't produce the same amount of wheat until 100 years later, until 5 years or 7 years ago, 2018. So wow. It literally destroys the, and that's exactly what you're seeing here is a Bolshevik coming in and clamping down on the church, the opposition, the media, and building a dictatorship. It's the same MO. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah. And so then we get at the why. What's the logic of why? What is the purpose? So, you know, again, Zelensky was put in power by the US and the EU as their controllable puppet. And he was given a blank check totaling at least $350 billion from the US. You can probably add the same thing from Europe or a little less. So, you know, $500+ billion. But most observers, including us, believe that the real purpose of that money was to make what I call Ukraine their own private Idaho. And their own private Idaho, where they could do three things with impunity: launder money with no banking or regulatory oversight, operate a censorship industrial complex whose purpose is to manipulate Western elections in the US and Europe. They've done both. And to conduct biologic experiments specifically focused on gain of function with, once again, no oversight. And
do you want me to try to run this video?
Yeah, yeah. If you have the one on the biolabs.
Well, what about the one with Zelensky coming into power?
Yeah, yeah. Let's. Yep. There we go. He fails to return the salute right there.
Я, Володимир Зеленський, урочисто присягаю на вірність Україні. Кожен з нас президент. Це не моя, це наша спільна перемога. Не тільки я приймав присягу. Кожен з нас.
So that was the video. You could see half the people in the Rada there are gone, have either fled or been killed. The other thing about that video that's informative is you see the Hollywood level production value of that video, the multiple camera angles, the close-ups, the zoom outs, the music, the walking through the doors. And that's not hearsay. We already know. He paid, what, $5 million to Sean Penn. He's had Hollywood directors over there. A team of Hollywood producer directors helped advise them on how to create some of the fake massacres that they've said the Russians have committed. It's unbelievable what they've done, but you see it in that video, and that's why I think it's informative. But back to the, you know, the three purposes, and I want to go to the biologic one because it looks like, thanks to Tulsi Gabbard, we're finally getting some kind of, some kind of investigation into what's going on there. And the U.S., thanks to Tulsi Gabbard, has just stated they'll inspect more than 120 labs that are spread through 30 different countries, 40 of them in Ukraine. And she added that the COVID-19 catastrophe shows the consequences of unchecked research into these dangerous pathogens and these biolaboratories, what they can do to the entire world. So the other part is, do you have the video of Julia Mendel?
Yes. The next one you had was Victoria Nuland, but
yeah, if you have that, we can play her because it's okay. It's good. She's the architect of these biolabs, but listen to her under when she's talking to the I think it's the Senate.
Now quite concerned, Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach.
And the point there is, she said, biological research labs.
Right.
It was very obvious that she was lying through her teeth.
Yeah. But I mean, just that she thinks she can admit that we set up 40 biologic research labs in a country that's not a first world country, thanks to what the EU and the US under the Obama administration did to Ukraine. But it's just, it's dangerous to the whole world. And those labs are still functioning. So obviously there's some project they're trying to complete in some period of time. Let's go to the Julia Mendel, his former press secretary, talking about the propaganda and what Zelensky said about propaganda.
Irritated. And he put his hands like this, what he was doing. He leaned to the table, he looked at us, and he said in a very irritated tone, "I need Goebbels propaganda if you want. I need Goebbels propaganda. I need thousands of talking heads of Goebbels propaganda."
Wow. So right there, that's it. That's what we're talking about. And that's his press secretary, loyal press secretary. She just had enough and she quit. And I want to read, because I don't have it on video, but I follow her. I've followed her since she resigned. And she said some incredibly poignant things. And this is just one of them. And again, her name's Julia Mendel. "Every subsequent deal for Ukraine will only be worse, because we are losing. We are losing people, territory, and the economy. The EU, which, by the way, has paid Russia more than 311 billion euros for energy and goods since the start of the war, has no real strategy, no way to stop fueling Russian budget or support Ukraine enough to win. They have no direct dialogue, also no direct dialogue with Moscow, and no meaningful leverage over either the Kremlin or Washington. Arguments that Russia has gained so little land almost sound childish." And so, "My country is bleeding out. Many who reflexively oppose every peace proposal believe they are defending Ukraine. With all respect, that is the clearest proof they have no idea of what's actually happening on the front lines and inside the country right now. War is not a Hollywood movie. I will never abandon the values that God and democracy both place at the very foundation of human existence. Human life is the highest good, and people, living, breathing people, are the ones who must be saved." And Todd, I don't think you and I could say it better. That's what we've been saying the whole time. She summed it up. This is not about pulling for Ukraine or pulling for Russia. It's about stopping this propaganda war and saving the lives of both countries' patriots who, unbeknownst to them, are fighting a war that has no real purpose to it.
You know, let me jump in there. One other thing that we reported on a couple months ago is that she came out and said that she confronted Zelensky and Yermak because Yermak was taking literally fluids from bodies out of the cemetery and bringing it in for like occult rituals with Zelensky. So, I mean, that's what you're dealing with here. And it comes from someone like her on the inside. She comes off as very credible, don't you think?
I do. I've been listening. I told you I follow her. I've been listening to her. And you heard that statement. That statement says it all. She's not saying she was wronged and she needs to get back at him. She's talking about what we've been talking about, which is, this is about the people and this is a fake war. And his Goebbels stuff just feathers into all the things we've talked about, the Bucha massacre, all the cover up of the Maidan protests and what followed in 2014 all the way to 22 when the war started. So, you know, you're hearing it from the inside, but that never gets out. And again, the real, one of the real downsides of what's happened is that we're taking our attention away from stopping this insanity. So just to add a few more exclamation points to the, you know, what Zelensky's done. Do you have the video of the men standing by the fence?
We've got the Yermak video now.
Yeah, you can pass that. It's just him getting out of jail yesterday. Okay. He met his bond. So, yeah, this is just shows a number of men captured at the border and, you know, trying to get out. And as we've said before, this is not a motivation problem. These are not cowardly Ukrainian men. This is a logic problem. The logic of why the Zelensky government is communicated to the people doesn't make sense to them. This war doesn't make sense to them. They love their country, yet they don't agree with what they've been told about why they're supposed to go and risk their livelihoods and their life for this war. And this means what that just tells us again in a very profound empirical way is that the purpose that the Zelensky government has told its people of the war doesn't make sense to them. And of course it doesn't. It never has and never will make sense to the people who have to live and fight and hopefully come back to Ukraine someday. So, and then the final thing, I think we've got a video of the head, the NATO chief there.
I've got two videos, one of the Ukrainian prisoner and one of the body exchange. And
then let's show those. Those are good. The prisoner is,
we'll start with that one.
Yeah.
То загребли, кинули в бусик. То все сака меня в Дніпропетровськ в учебку, там такой был большой курятник, и там мы пробыли 4 дня. Потом я слышал уже, когда я был в Скале, что туда прилетело пару ракет. Обычных людей словили с улицы, больных, за 50 лет, и тупо заставляли их, ну, унижали. В Скале, ну, вот, допустим, ну, все наркоманы, алкоголики, поголовно. Они к людям относились как к животным. Я пришел на позицию и решил, что надо делать лыжи, потому что меня завалят или свои, или убьют русские военные, потому что иду против России. Оно мне не надо, я стрелять не хочу. Я не знаю, за что я воюю. За что мне воевать? Россию не победить.
Yeah, and you know, drug abuse and alcoholism are not specific to the Ukrainian military here, but it becomes epidemic when it's a lot, when you have unmotivated soldiers and you have soldiers who are dropped off at locations without being told why they're being dropped off and they have no training. You're going to fear when you're not prepared. So it's another automatic fear response when you're thrown into a complex situation and you're not in any way prepared for it. And that's most of these forced conscripts. And so, you know, when you think back of all those young men standing by the fence, captured, trying to escape the country, they understand this. They've got relatives who've already sent letters home or called home and told them what's going on. They know what is happening and what will happen to them if they're captured by the forced conscriptors and they're sent to the front lines. And now you can show the body exchange, which is just one more body exchange, shows the lopsided body count between Russia and Ukraine. But it's also a poignant reminder that we're not talking theory here, or we're not talking about intangibles. We're talking about thousands of men's lives that are evaporating before our eyes on a daily basis.
So I guess the text is almost like 500 to 41 or something like that, right?
Yeah, which, you know, is the pattern we've seen in all these exchanges. They were 39 to 1. I think this one's a little less, but it's still hugely lopsided.
Yeah.
And still huge everyone should look at that. That should be on the news media too. This is not a sporting event where you just have a side and you pull for the side and put a placard in your front yard that you're on that side. This is a human catastrophe of epic proportions, and nothing has changed as far as the urgency everyone should have in ending it. And yep. then just to put an exclamation point on it, this is Root, the head of NATO, telling all the NATO countries that this is a serious thing. They need to put aside 0.25% of their GDP to give to Ukraine every year so that Ukraine can budget around $150 billion a year that it can count on each year to keep this war going. And these are countries with rotting economies in serious trouble. Germany yesterday put out some unbelievably dire economic news. France and Britain are in the same boat. And yet, you'd have to ask yourself again, why would they even suggest giving 0.25% of their GDP into perpetuity to the Ukrainian war effort when they have people at home who are starving, who can't afford basic goods, and who can't even find a job?
And their security, they're at risk of violent crime daily.
Yep. Yeah.
By the way, we're part of NATO, by the way. So what's 0.25%, you know?
It's a lot. But it just circles back to what we're talking about. What's the purpose? How can this insanity be not just supported, but being accelerated as time goes on? And it just comes back to those three things: money laundering with impunity, a isolated, secure censorship industrial election turning complex, and the ability to do biologic experiments with no regulatory oversight. And so with that, that concludes my update on Iran and Ukraine.
All right, so we're going to close the show out here. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow in the studio, 10 to noon, Monday through Friday on the Skiff. We've got the Georgia show coming Sunday at 2 p.m. Please sign up for our social, CDM1 on Rumble, CDM on YouTube. Follow us there, CDM_press on X. Thank you, Pete, and we'll see you next week.